Welcome to Tilf Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking grazing. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at a new Texas-sized drone for spraying. Ag History Minute, we'll talk Arthur William Sampson. In our Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events. And we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilf Agronomy. Well, did you guys have a good Thanksgiving?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy your turkey and whatever else you may have eaten with said turkey?
Stuffing is the go-to for me.
Mashed potatoes.
Is it always just stuffing? Or do you ever have non-traditional Thanksgiving? That's what we usually get at my mother-in-law's.
Like, what does that
like
mean?
Like pizza?
Yeah.
She made chicken cordon bleu. And the questioning part is, it was like chicken tenders and ham kind of mixed together. And I'm not sure it was Swiss cheese. And it was a different cheese. But my brother-in-law works at the cheese plant.
Oh, right. So you probably got
so it may not have been
stuff,
Swiss. Yeah. It may have been something different.
Fancier?
I wouldn't call it fancier. Provolone? Just different.
You got to stick with the traditional stuff, right? Like, that's the best.
Well, I personally like turkey. Like,
I
don't have a problem with turkey. We've done, like, turkey and ham some years and just to have some variety, but.
Anything with gravy. Turkey with gravy.
Vitamin G.
You get stuffing with gravy.
Yep.
And then mashed potatoes with gravy. Green beans.
Cranberries with gravy.
Cranberries can be
there. Do you make turkey gravy then after Thanksgiving with the leftovers?
Just all gravy stuff, yes.
That's what my mother always would do with leftover turkey is make it into turkey gravy. So then she'd mix like the gravy and the turkey together and put it over leftover mashed potatoes.
We didn't have enough turkey left over to do that this year, so.
Yeah, you both, the biggest question for you both smoked turkeys.
Yep.
Was that successful? That is one hard part about, I think the hardest part about hosting isn't always, I mean, you got all the cleaning, you have all the stuff that goes with it, but then you have this massive 20-pound turkey plus, 20 to 30-pound turkey to thaw, cook, and have ready on time. For all these people that if it doesn't work
and match it all up. The worst part is like matching it up as your wife's doing all the other stuff and her level of stress is rising because
right, you're busy.
Is the turkey ready when the mashed potatoes are ready when she's got to put the stuffing in the oven? Like all that Jenga's got to come together.
So was the smoking the turkey successful? Is it good because it alleviates the oven then so you have that to make the other stuff like
it was successful. It was a hit. Everyone said they liked the smoked turkey. This was the first year we had done a smoked turkey. I know Bill, you've done it before, but so we had a traditionally cooked turkey and a smoked turkey, so they were turkey.
You
it was
double turkey.
I don't remember how big the other one was. I think it was an 18 pounder and a 15 pounder. I cooked the 15 pounder in the smoker. And
could you tell what? Yeah,
you
tell the ratio of leftovers.
There was not much smoked turkey left.
No, there's never.
It's juicy.
Yeah.
It's flavorful. It's very good.
The only thing with the smoke cooker that maybe it's just my smoker is it never like truly looks done. There's still a little pinkish to it. I don't know what yours is, Matt, but the 3 years I've done it now. The breast meat still has a little tinge of pink, but it's well over temperature.
Oh, and that's a.
Did you ever
smoke
burgers?
That's just a smoking thing. Yeah, the smoke ring.
The first time. Yeah, we had smoke burgers. Yeah, smoke ring. That's what they call it. Yeah.
Which you would get with
pink inside.
You used to get with charcoal, too.
Right.
Like if you did like when I grew up, we had a charcoal grill. So I was kind of used to that stuff from back then.
Did you have the little ring thing that's plugged in the wall and you put in the coals
we did actually
burnt the crap out of your hand?
It had like a plastic handle on it, but you'd stick it in. It looked like the element from your stove, basically,
right.
But in a hoop shape. Yep. Yeah, we had one of those back in the day.
Did you use a meat thermometer to double check?
Yeah.
Oh yeah,
because the Google machine says as long as The meat thermometer says 165 degrees Fahrenheit. You're good. The pink color is perfectly safe to eat. It's primarily due to a pigment called myoglobin in the meat that reacts with smoke during cooking.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
So it's...
Yeah. Yeah, so I wasn't worried about the pink part of it at all. It was... The skin was actually kind of nice and crispy for the most part, except for the bottom, like what sat down. That was good. But yeah, no, it turned out well. Everybody was a fan. Nobody was like, oh God, this is the worst turkey ever. And yeah, there was not much left over of the smoked turkey.
We maybe had a quarter pound, maybe, left over. Not even enough to...
What size did you smoke, Bill?
I think it was 18 pounder.
Yep. What's the max in a smoker? I mean, could you do a bigger one in there?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think.
You're just smoking it longer.
It depends how big your smoker is, too.
Well, right. Right.
Because I think mine, I forget what it says, like two full size chickens, or I forget what size, like turkey would fit in there. Plus, like I took the top rack out of, because mine's like barrel shaped. So I took the top rack out and then. I ended up actually putting it in a roaster. I was going to do a foil pan, but my wife couldn't find one big enough. So I put it in
like a roasting
like a regular
pan,
roasting
sure.
pan.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
had plenty of room in there
yeah.
for... I couldn't do two turkeys that way, like two small turkeys if I had smaller roasting pans maybe, but yeah.
Well, bigger question, what kind of pellets?
I did pecan.
Roasting corn pellets?
I think I told you, Matt, last week, okay. like I think the pellet thing is overrated.
Oh, like you... it. That it's, as long as it's just a good pellet,
yeah.
it's fine.
Yeah.
It's not like and some sort of trick that you.
I get like this the guy special. In Seymour's pellets because there's a lot like Traeger seems to have a lot of chaff.
Yep,
with their pellets,
I found that too. Yeah, that it's like sawdust at the bottom.
Yeah,
yep. Shout out to Seymour Corn Heat.
Yep,
he's got Lumberjack, right I believe, is the brand. They're Canadian pellets, but they work good. They don't taste like maple syrup.
I did vacuum out the underneath, though, where...
Oh, yeah, the fire
before
pot.
I started, yeah, just to make sure there was no...
I should do that on mine now. I had cleaned it, yeah, before. Like, not immediately before, but a little while before. I hadn't done a lot of other things before I did the turkey, but when it runs for that long, I'm sure it's due for a good cleaning.
Matt's helped me deep fry a turkey. Or we did chickens at one time.
We did turkey, too.
We did turkey, too, yeah.
Mr. Giblets.
Yep.
And yeah. that he had a name.
Yeah.
Yes, the turkey this year was it was Giblet 2.
So it was next year.
Because it was the second
three?
Turkey.
Part
two. No, it was the second turkey, so that's why it was Giblet 2.
Oh, that way.
Like Air Force 1 and Air Force 2.
Sure.
Was the vice turkey.
Because it was smaller. Why did you get Giblet 2? Yours got 8 and more. You should have been Giblet 1.
It was the first time we've done it, so.
Okay.
So was your...
You don't put all your eggs in the basket, you don't know.
Was Giblet 1 imported in from another household, or did you have that one in your oven?
Well, yeah, so I was importing Giblet 2 to my mother's house.
You were leaving.
Yeah so you I took mine on the road.
You didn't bring your smoker on the road, you brought the turkey on the road?
Right, finished the turkey, then, and believe me, this was not a problem for my wife. She rode with the warm turkey on her lap then. Like, I just... put down a towel, put the roasting pan on it, and like wrapped it in the towel, and then she...
Did you buckle in the turkey, or your wife first?
My wife was buckled in.
Okay.
Yeah. We did not have an extra seatbelt to buckle the turkey.
Yeah, I thought maybe go have your wife sit down, put it on, then buckle in the whole turkey.
She won out that day, because then we went to her mom's for dinner, and I made cheese potatoes in a crock pot, so then she had the warm crock pot to ride with. So she was...
So you took that to mom's, too?
No,
we
stopped
home.
Ah. It works out because, you know, my mom's south of town and my in-laws are...
Northwest.
Northsiders, yeah.
West, slightly north, yeah. So.
Right, right, fair.
So it's on the way.
Got it.
Can't beat Thanksgiving with football.
Yep, three games. The Bears sucked, as per usual.
Per usual.
Dallas squeaked one out against the Giants, and then, yeah, the Packers... beat up on the Dolphins. So I will be impressed now, because as of the time our listeners are listening, the Packers will have played 3 games in like 10 or 11 days here. Like, that's... they're going through a pretty good marathon here. No time off.
They'll be happy for their mini bye.
Mini bye.
Right. because they had their official buy right before this gauntlet, and now they'll have the mini buy.
It's hard to believe there's only a month left.
Yeah, like five we're games. Getting down to the end of the calendar year here.
Yep.
It's December.
Our first snow squall yesterday.
Yeah, that was wild.
It was a squall for sure. Yeah, there was times where it just was giving her
just a whiteout, and then after the squall was done, the roads were like ice rinks, a lot of accidents. Even the roundabout was a little more difficult to navigate here.
It was backed up like out of town 3 miles to 54 and 55. Really? Yeah, it was that. People were going slow, which was good. So, but it was almost like everybody was taking it really slow, which is good and at times bad, where you're just like, well, okay, we got to go here too. Like,
I couldn't stop to turn onto my road to go home. Like, I had to
do it in one of those.
Align the truck, and then when there's opening, step on the gas.
Like, yeah.
If I had to come to a complete stop, I wouldn't have.
Yeah. Ice is the worst. Yeah. When you can't, and stopping sucks, but even this morning, there were still some ice patches at intersections where at stop signs when I wanted to go, you couldn't go that. Spin, and then you're like, not that there were ever any close calls, but there's like,
flip it into four.
I could make this easy, but yeah, it was in the auto. Do you guys roll in the auto?
I don't have an auto. It's either on
you
or
don't
off.
Have an auto?
No. Nope.
Okay. Really?
I think mine is either, yeah.
What? Yeah, okay. auto's the way to go. Then just does it. And you just be mad at the truck if you go in the ditch. Like, why didn't you go in four-wheel drive? Truck?
No, I guess mine...
Flip it in auto.
I think mine does. I do. Yeah, I did not put it in four-wheel drive, though. For
most... Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was because I was here, and then I went home, so it wasn't, wasn't going that far.
You were rolling four-wheel drive high, Bill?
Oh, yeah.
Did yours have a four-wheel drive low?
Yes.
Okay.
You have to push it in, and then turn it, so you can't, like accidentally go from two to four low. You got to make an effort to go from to four low. But yeah, I rolled with the four.
Yeah, mine's just a dial, and it does have the auto. I just rarely ever use it. I either put it in a four high or four low, or
no, let the machines decide, man.
Okay, you and ChatGPT.
Yes.
And, no, I used live to your not, lives how you want.
I used to not be an auto person. Now it just seems like it's easy. Like, oh, there you go. Just if you need it, I guess.
So you just leave it in auto all the time?
No, I don't, because my gas mileage does go down.
I was going to say.
So then when I do forget, when the weather is good, like it's still in auto now, so I should flip it back out. Because, yeah, it does seem like it'll
like,
flip on and off.
Feel
into
like the
it
machine
sometimes.
Is going to, yeah.
Yeah.
Make some mistakes.
And then I'll be like, why did I go through so much gas? Because it probably drops by 5 miles per gallon.
Yeah. So, yeah, or when you're turning, you feel everything kind of biting. Like, that's weird.
The four auto people are four big oil, you're saying?
Kev? I don't know. No. Yeah, that's maybe
it's a scam. By big oil to get you to use more gas. All right. Well, you guys ready to get into our topic for today?
Yep.
So we're going to talk grazing today. And it's interesting to me how far things have come in the world of grazing the last few years, especially with kind of how we can do it. And, you know, usually it was just like, oh, you got a dedicated pasture and you needed the permanent fence and different paddocks if you wanted paddocks to rotationally graze.
Or it's just one big field that they pound the crap out of.
Right. Or yeah, they just kind of run roughshod across the whole thing. And
the word pasture has been used loosely over the years. Like,
yes. There is very definition.
Like, think of growing up, right. What we had. It was
dirt. It wasn't a pasture.
The back was pasture-ish, but it was like a schlep hole, I think was the technical term I once heard an engineer use, like right off the concrete, and then it got to be dirt, and then there was like a little bit of grass in the back.
Yeah.
So yeah, mud, dirt, grass.
Yeah.
It was a nice transition.
I like schlep.
Schlep hole.
And it was always like...
Oh, yeah, they're up to their hocks.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know the terms better than me. Oh, yeah, yes.
Big time.
I think we just use the term slop hole instead of schlep hole, but yes. But anyway, so yeah, you know, your definition could definitely vary on that. And unless you're really looking to do rotational grazing year-round, you don't really want... I mean, we've worked for how many years now taking out old fences, fence lines, combining fields, making bigger fields. So I don't think a lot of people are like, oh, yeah, I just want to go back to farming everything in like 10-acre chunks. But you don't necessarily have to. And that's kind of the neat thing about where grazing has gone the last few years. Obviously, you need animals to graze. That's the first part. So if you're looking for, as a cash grain operation, I mean, I do know some cash grain guys who have,
they don't have to be
a
cattle.
Desire to bring other people's cattle to their farm to graze. But yeah. So
can you graze your tractors?
Sure.
Your chopper kind of grazes.
Yeah. Your chopper does, but it spits it right back out.
Right.
So, you know, giving up cropping acres isn't necessarily ideal for some guys, and it doesn't have to be that anymore. It doesn't have to be a dedicated 100% always a pasture situation. And one of the biggest things in the last couple of years has been cover crop grazing. So, you know, we've talked about forage cover crops and doing that in the spring, getting kind of a double crop situation where you take that forage off, plant corn, and you take it for silage or even grain, depending on how soon you harvest it. And having that as an option, well, now, you know, what if you didn't have to do the mechanical part of harvesting it? What if you could just graze it? And that is actually an option now. I mean, it's something that some farms are doing, and late fall, early spring can be times to get grazing opportunities. It's kind of like, you know, I was talking about double dipping, like your crop acres or that extra, like the forage was to begin with. So it can add feed value. Means you don't have to mechanically harvest. I mean, you still can, but you wouldn't necessarily have to. And grazing cover crops can provide manure distribution. So it's less manure you'd have to haul by having the animals out there for a prolonged period of time.
As I talk to growers that do this, I thought the feeding one might be, but it's the manure one. That seemed to be the one where they said, like, and not that, that makes sense. Like, guys don't mind feeding cattle. Like, usually you have the feed stored. I mean, it saves them on purchasing, I think. That helps, you know, say you're having to buy some of it. Or I'm not saying that part isn't important or isn't helpful, but the manure part, I know they always talk about how sweet that is. Like, yeah, I don't have to, you know, for these 2-3 months in the fall, like, they haul their own manure. So
think about how nice this fall was for grazing.
It was
really good growth of, even if you planted your covers of fuzz late, you still had really good growth. It wasn't cold, didn't freeze early, plenty of opportunity to graze, plenty of foliage for all those to graze. So that was a really cool part about this fall. And we've had several falls lately that have kind of stacked up. Maybe not this well, but pretty good.
Even last year where we didn't have the, you know, we couldn't establish cover crops through interseeding or other things in dry periods, you still, like, cows will gnaw on corn stalks and other stuff. There's still opportunities to get them out there. And you might have to supplement a little bit of feed in that scenario, but they're still, like Todd said, getting rid of the manure themselves. They're land applying it for you. And so there's an added value to that.
It blows me away of, like, when we soil sample over corn grain fields, like, combines today are not leaving much out there. You know, they are not the combines of old that, you know, guys would call silver seeders and what, you know.
Yep, all those.
All those old names for how they are. I remember even... I think it was Harold Tech at FFA talking about, was one of the old FFA advisors from many, many years ago, is they used to have, after harvest, they would go, like, grab cobs that were left behind, and then I forgot how they sold them, but somehow, like, FFA kids would go walk out, grab all these cobs, and then, you know, the farmer would give them to them for free, just because whatever, and then they would take them and do something with them, and it was like a bit of a fundraiser or something, but you can't, like, there's no cobs laying out there to do that today. So, you'd think grazing cattle out there, like, what do they have to eat? But they don't seem to have a problem at all. Like, they...
They'll eat corn stalks.
Yeah.
The leaves that are there, the dandelions or whatever else that might be grown out there, they'll eat that for you, too. I mean, they don't see weeds as something like, oh, I'm not going to eat that. Some of that stuff they'll just eat right off the field, too.
And it does seem to help. Like, what is our biggest complaint with corn grain and the reason to do tillage on it is residue management.
Right.
And they are an excellent way to manage residue. I mean, if you want to talk about what animals were supposed to do or their role in this, I mean, that's exactly what it was, is to sort of basically their pug marks or hoof prints, you know, kind of is that little bit of, I don't want to call it tillage, but it kind of pushes that down, and then they, you know, their manure will help and just all that. And it just seems like they can manage that residue very well. Now, it's hard to do that on a large scale necessarily. You're not doing it over, you know, hundreds of acres, but over an 80 acre field or something like that, they definitely can do a lot of help to that residue.
And I've seen guys too, like, take bigger fields and just put a perimeter fence, you know, leave a 10-foot strip around, you know, so you can manage weeds at the fence or just get to the back quickly, but manage that, and we still crop it, you know. And then, like you said, Todd, you combine the corn and let's throw 100 head of cattle out there, whether that's heifers or steers or beef cows or something that you can... You're not managing at home at the home farm. If you have them in a certain place at home, you're not dealing with the manure. You don't have to scrape it up and put it in the pit and then haul it. You're, like you said, Matt, you're already doing that.
Well, and cover crop grazing too, it isn't true, or doesn't have to be true rotational grazing. You can give them a big chunk and let them
go,
let them run for a while, and then just move the fence. You know, it's not like you got to be there moving the fence every day or even every other day.
This if isn't you don't like, want to. This isn't like managed grass pasture where you're giving them a, you know, 10-acre swat or a 5-acre swat and then continue moving. This is like whatever they take, right? Because it's just extra forage that's out there and they can eat what they need.
And so, like, one example I've got of a farm that I worked with doing this, they interseeded, and some of the stuff they interseeded isn't going to overwinter. So the cows will eat that, but some of it will. And so next spring there might be something out there where, you know, we're not talking months, but they might get a couple of weeks out there where, again, it's a couple of weeks you don't have to collect the manure, a couple of weeks you don't have to feed them necessarily if there's enough out there. And even in years like this where, you know, Bill, you talked about some that got late, if you didn't get a ton of growth out there and it wasn't worth mechanically harvesting for forage, letting them eat out there, you know, you don't need as much biomass to let them graze it versus if you're, you know, it doesn't pay to go out there and cut a couple swaths and maybe get a wagon or a wagon and a half of feed, but they can graze on that for, and I don't have a good number of days or whatever, but, you know, it's, they're going to get more out of it that way than trying to harvest it.
Matt, in that situation, they interseeded in corn grain, or was it silage, or what did they interseed?
This was silage, but they, I've seen it in grain too.
Well, I think that's a good point though, with silage. I mean, you open up, you know, let's just talk about the temporal fact of this or the time. So after winter wheat, you have a huge window to allow that. So maybe, you know, near where you have your cattle or you have to move your cattle with some water to a spot, but you have a winter wheat field that you can, you know, either let them graze on the volunteer wheat if it's the chaff spread out, or, you know, let them graze on another crop that you plant into it. There's a lot of, I mean, you have basically from, I wouldn't say even August, but because you want it to grow a little bit back, but I mean, basically you have, say, September for sure, you know, all the way till freeze up or when it's way too cold for the cattle to be out there. The next one would be corn silage, and that too, you'd allow quite a lot of time. Yeah. One thing with corn silage, it does seem that, like we just talked with corn grain, there's leaves and stems and just stuff for them to kind of eat and rustle around in. Corn silage, if you just have silage, right, there's not enough for them to truly do anything.
Right.
It feels same with soybeans. I've never seen it work well with just soybean residue.
You're almost too late at that point,
right?
Too, right.
Right.
Like you're in October now.
But soybeans would give an opportunity for an interseeding type of situation too.
Yeah. If you drop some rye in there at leaf drop, and we're able to let it go for a little bit, you'd potentially have something there to graze.
Yeah. And then
right here.
And then, like we said, corn grain, either with interseeding or potentially not for that kind of end of the year. But all of these still give you, I mean, there's still months more than it. We're talking weeks, which is
right.
Which is all helpful. And then that's not counting the window in spring that opens up, because that window in spring can be variable. You know, it depends when.
Yeah, if it's too wet, you don't want to throw them out there. You just muck up the field. And
right.
But what's interesting too is that, you know, if you can, depending on the layout of your farm, you can run tandem where you've got those wheat acres next to some corn acres, get them started on the wheat, move them to the corn. I mean, you're just prolonging that period that they're out there. We had a farm, I think it was 2 years ago, they raised canning peas, put in a cover crop after that, interseeded the corn right next to it. They were out there from like September to December, maybe even early January. So, I mean, 3 months where you didn't have to supplement much. I mean, maybe they threw a couple of bales out there. I don't remember offhand anymore. But, you know, they weren't supplementing a lot of feed. They weren't, you know, storing manure. You're not scraping pens, scraping barn. Like, big savings for them in that way. And even if you decide you wanted to do a dedicated pasture, a lot of times the early spring grazing window, by the time you wait to get them out there so they're not wrecking the fields, you end up taking a first crop off of a bunch of the pastures. So you're still getting some cropping benefit to those dedicated pasture acres too. And I think what's really kind of come in, and we'll talk a little bit more about it later too in one of our in our Field Good Friday there, but you know, whether it's heifer steers, dry cows, whatever you're out there grazing, it's minimal inputs. You might need a perimeter fence, but they've got technology now, even with these collars that they're coming out with. Where, I mean, you still probably want a perimeter fence of some kind, but it doesn't have to be this big, beefy, you know, permanent fence.
I'm just laughing because in our area, if you just threw cattle out there with no fence, you'd have so many calls that like, your cattle are out, and what do you do? You know,
show them your phone and be like, I can move them however I want right here. Like,
boop. And they, so you need almost just some sort of visual tape out there. That
but it could be fiberglass posts with a single or double wire.
Right, correct.
It doesn't have to be big old wood posts permanent with high tension wire.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's, I'm not saying, and those collars aren't necessarily cheap either. So I'm not saying it's a cheap option necessarily, but it's not as involved as it had to be a few years ago. I remember in my uncle's farm when he did some rotational grazing stuff, I was probably like 16 when we set up the fence and stuff. And that was a, you know, it was a process getting everything ready and you had to move them and everything else. Like now you could do it so much quicker and simpler in a way that, you know, especially if you're not looking for permanent pasturing, it can be fairly quick and easy. Relative to a lot of things on the farm. So, and saving, like I said, saving those mechanical costs, those manure costs could be worth it in the end if you can get enough time for those cattle to be out of the barn, you know, even if they're in the barns. Just getting them some of that outside time where you don't have to manage them in the barn and just let them kind of do their thing.
There's a few considerations as far as, And maybe as agronomist, I always struggle with these of like, even like horse people ask me of bloats or certain issues from harvested forages, but from grazing forages, you do have to watch to some of that. I know we've talked about grass tetany, you know, and low magnesium levels and on this podcast before, but bloat, and there's just other problems that can occur. So that is certain things to watch. You do have to kind of keep an eye when you first get your cattle out there of, and different cattle will react differently to certain things.
Like sorghum is a good one if you have sorghum out there. The prussic acid
thing
is there.
Right.
So especially after a frost in the fall.
That's not what today's podcast is about. I just want to bring up as far as there's a little bit of watch outs there.
Oh, yeah.
And I do think sometimes, though, those watch outs freak us out more than, because you never want to lose cattle.
Right.
You never want to have death loss or sickness because it costs a lot of money. So that is something to watch, but maybe you talk to your veterinarian beforehand or your cattle nutritionist and say, here's the plan, or, you know, what are there any things I got to watch? But I do think there's enough freak things that they don't always anticipate either.
Yeah. No, it's another form of management. And you have to be willing to, again, even if you're not moving them every day, it's still going to take some work to make sure you got somebody moving them, make sure they got water access, whether that means letting them come back up to the barn to get water or running some kind of water out there. And the deeper you go into winter, I mean, this year especially, we went from warm to cold very fast. Yes.
2 days.
So, you know, having stuff freeze up and that would be a pain too. So it's not a 100% a no-brainer, but it's, like I said, it's come a long way from what I think we think of when we think of traditional grazing and how that became, you know, that kind of management that it took for those things, how that's changed and how, you know, it's just another way to utilize resources that we've got on the farm to hopefully give us a little bit of relief somewhere else. So yeah, there you go. There's some ideas to think about when you think of grazing. It's not just dedicated pastures anymore. There are other opportunities, and it doesn't even have to be dairy cattle, you know, beef cattle or any other type of animals. Giving them some time out in the field can be a positive. So now we'll move into our spotlight for today. They say everything's bigger in Texas. They have a Texas-sized drone now that's been unveiled. The Spray Hawk announces a retrofit kit and will be available next year. Rotor Technologies will begin shipping its autonomous application helicopters. Yes, you heard that right, helicopter, not a little drone. Spray Hawk features a 110-gallon tank and can cover 240 acres per hour. So it's not a huge helicopter, but it is a lot bigger than your standard drone. The Rotor Technology Spray Hawk is coming from a New Hampshire-based startup that has demonstrated the Spray Hawk's airworthiness to a large group of ag professionals at a airport at Perro Field in Fort Worth. This gas-powered autonomous helicopter is equipped with a 33-foot spray boom and a 110-gallon tank. The CEO, Hector Zhu, says the autonomous choppers can cover 240 acres per hour, a vast leap forward over many spray drone technologies on the market today. Costs about $2 an acre to operate and can be flown safely with a two-person crew consisting of a remote pilot in charge and a visual observer. FAA regulatory approval via the 44807 exemption for commercial agriculture operations will be included in purchase. The company will also provide in-person training for smooth integration of this particular copter. As far as price goes, the R55 ready-to-spray package will cost you about $1.5 million. A Spray Hawk retrofit kit, which will convert an existing Robinson R44 chopper into a flying autonomous sprayer, would set you back about $700,000. So not a cheap option, but it's still kind of an interesting jump in technology when we think about how much, you know, how many acres a small drone can cover versus the 240 that this one can cover in that time. There's an early adopter discount available until December 15th of this year if you're sold on the idea and want to get one of these right away. But the press release announced pricing and availability for 2025 does not specifically mention financing options, but there may be some out there. So it'll be interesting to see how quickly this gets adopted and if we start seeing some of these big choppers in our neck of the woods. So
when I first look at this, I'm like, that just looks like a helicopter I've seen them using to like pollinate or, you know, net, yeah, and spray with, I guess. So now it's the same, like you say, when it's in a Robinson R-44 that you could have a pilot in if you wanted.
Yep.
But you could operate it as a drone as well. So that's interesting. It's huge. It just looks like a regular helicopter. So, of course, you can do a lot of acres, you know, do a lot of things with it. But
well, and being a helicopter, too, your takeoff and landing is a little bit easier than if it was a plane, which is kind of nice. But yeah, definitely not cheap. So, all right. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So Arthur William Sampson, who is he? Well, he's a impressive list of firsts. He was the first person in America to be called a range ecologist, first to promote deferred and rotational grazing strategies, first to develop usable concepts of indicator species and plant succession for evaluating range conditions. He was the first to write a college text on range management, first range ecologist hired by the U.S. Forest Service, and the first director of what is now called the Intermountain Research Station. The first mention of the term rotational grazing can be traced back to the year 1950 when Arthur Sampson organized a symposium on rotational grazing in North America at the third annual meeting of the Society for Range Management. The basic principles of range management that are now taken for granted came from the early research of Sampson and James T. Jardine, the first director of the Forest Service's Office of Grazing Studies, created in 1910. They include using the kind of livestock best adapted to the range, grazing proper numbers, grazing in proper season, and good distribution of livestock. So it's kind of interesting to think 1950 is really when rotational grazing started. It's, you'd think,
feels like it should be
it should have been longer than
way than yeah that, think of when grazing started to when we're like, yeah, maybe we should move them around a little
just
bit.
Not
yeah,
let not
just put them in one spot all the time.
Not just let them do whatever in this big old pasture area. Even that, I bet you his first books people are like, whatever, I'm not
this quack.
Yeah.
We have to actually go out in the pasture and move them every day? What?
That sounds like a lot of work.
All right. Thank you, Matt. And thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's really easy. On your iPhone, go to Apple Podcasts and search Tilth Talk Radio. Or on your Android phone, download an app like Podcast Addict. And there you can also search Tilth Talk Radio. You can listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcast. And you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Now we'll get into some Cool Beans That's Corny with current events. So Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week. Farmer sentiment has reached its highest levels since 2021. So according to ag economists, they say farmer concern about potential trade war doesn't impact this month's Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer. Big improvement was mostly on the side of future expectations. Future expectation index jumped up 37 points this month. People became more optimistic in general and especially more optimistic about the future. The barometer had a post-election bounce when President Trump was elected the first time, and he thinks it's something that they'll continue to look at and monitor with this new election. So nationwide, the Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer is a nationwide measure of the health of the U.S. agricultural economy and surveys 400 agricultural producers on economic sentiment each month. So it's something we've talked about before, and I think it was just this last summer that was kind of down at a low level, and now we're jumping back up, which is a good positive thing for farmers. Being in a good state of mind and positive about the future is important. Our That's Corny this week. Cargill is looking to terminate about 475 employees in Minnesota. Cargill has told Minnesota it will permanently lay off the 475 employees from facilities in the state starting on February 5th. So a global trading house, Cargill, has told Minnesota about these layoffs and says it plans to cut around 5% of its staff after revenue slumped in the most recent fiscal year as crop prices have hit multi-year lows. Agricultural merchants, including the privately held Cargill, are under pressure as prices of the commodity crops they trade, such as wheat, corn, and soybeans, have dropped to near four-year lows, and crop processing margins have shrunk. Cargill's Minnesota employees work at an office center in Wayzata and are tagged to the facility but live elsewhere, the company said in a letter to the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. So Cargill is undergoing a business restructuring that is resulting in the reduction in force, particularly of that office center in Wayzata. So unfortunate for those folks. Hopefully the positivity that's coming from the Ag Barometer will maybe lead to a change in this before it happens. I mean, we've got a couple months yet. Maybe they can change their mind. Who knows? All right. And our Field Good Friday then this week, since we were talking about grazing, seemed convenient timing. This got published just a couple days ago here this week. So Waupaca County farmers are seeing virtual fencing as a means to increase operating efficiency. So over in Manawa, Wepner Farms have been playing with the idea of GPS cattle collars this fall. They have them on 10 heifers, and they've been keeping them in the boundaries with the fence, the virtual fencing. It's kind of like a dog collar for invisible fence. It beeps when they get close to the perimeter, and they're trained to respond to those beeps and not cross the invisible boundary. It does have the capability of giving them a little jolt if they get too close or past the boundary line. And since they're utilizing cover crops in how they're grazing, not only are they getting the soil health benefits of it, so increasing soil organic matter, improving soil fertility, but they are also getting feed value from it. So Jeff Wepner and his son Alex have added the virtual fence component to their cover crop grazing. They crop about 1,500 acres, milk 350 cows in a 6-unit robot milking system, and also raise beef steers. And they're moving the interior fencing for grazing cattle on a daily basis was a problem for their workforce. So they talked to NRCS and were able to get a few of these collars to try out this fall. I actually got a chance to go out there and see them. They're, you guys can see in the picture, but for the folks at home, it's almost looks like the size of a basketball hanging around their neck, like even bigger than a cowbell. It's got solar panels on either side, so they keep some charge.
It looks like an old St. Bernard's little barrel that you see in those pictures in the days.
Did you wear one, Matt?
No.
They did not affix you.
I've asked that question of everyone I've ever talked to about this. Like, oh, did you try it out on yourself?
Didn't want to get zapped.
But I don't think, like, I'm willing to bet that the three of us here have all touched the fence at some point. And having it hanging around your neck would be even worse than when you, you know, grabbed it with your hand or touched it with your arm or whatever it was. So I feel like you could pee on these and not have to worry, unlike the electric fence. But yeah,
I thought it'd be more of like a bracelet around their ankles that they would wear.
Yeah. But yeah, they've been using them now for, I think it's been just over a month, and been able to change the fence. So they're using collars from a Norwegian company called No Fence. There's a Gallagher's No Fence with the first one that came out. There's the Gallagher's E Shepherd. So there's a couple different companies that have them out there. As long as they stay in the sun, I know some of them you have to swap out batteries and stuff because they'll wear out. But with the solar panels on these, it's supposed to keep them going.
It's cool that they have solar panels.
Yeah.
That's you wouldn't want the battery to go out. Well, and you wouldn't be able to move your cows.
You wouldn't think that would like
work. Or track them.
You know, you wouldn't think you'd get enough sun, but at the same time, it would help make it last way longer.
Yeah. Well, and unless it's zapping them. Like, I imagine.
Sure, the beep doesn't take a lot of power in GPS.
The power usage isn't huge.
So will it beep to get them to like move a certain direction and then stop once they move that way. I don't follow how it could. I'm just picturing a rotational grazing where you have that one line of fence and you just sort of move it along on both sides.
So it's tied to how the animal's moving. So if they're moving toward a boundary line, it'll start to beep the closer they get to the boundary line and increase the frequency of the beeps. But it doesn't, like when you change the fence, you usually don't change both parameters of the fence. You open up one direction more.
Right.
And then you kind of let them find that.
Okay.
And then
close the other
close it off on the other side.
And they're probably going to graze to the better forage, right?
Right. They're going to want to go where the food is. So usually.
They always do. It's stopping them from keeping going. So I guess that's true. That's what this is doing.
Yeah. We're out there for a field day and we had probably 25 people or something out there with the cattle. And they were moving around us, and none of them, while we were out there, got, like, they didn't try to run through the invisible fence or anything.
Do they have a perimeter?
They have a single polywire perimeter, yeah.
Oh, so a very small perimeter.
Yeah, there's not a ton of perimeter. They said they weren't really, when we were out there that day, they weren't pushing the boundaries really at all. But, yeah, and you can track them, too, so you can look on. Go on the computer and you can find like where they all are. You can see kind of how they're dispersed. It's the biggest thing is they don't make the collars, right? I believe anyway, they don't make the collars for calves. Like they're only for the full size cattle. So if you had like cow calf pairs, it'd be a little more problematic. But that's the same is true of regular grazing. A lot of times those calves can run out of the fence and they usually come back, but.
I do like the quote that it says, 9 of our 10 heifers learned right away.
Yep.
So there's always
one idiot that has your, gah. Especially heifers. They always, just be spooky about it or just.
It's the reason I went to the plant side.
But yeah, there's a monthly fee associated with it of $300. The collar themselves were $300 plus a monthly fee to run them, but you could turn that on and off. So if you're not grazing all the time, you know, if. Like, say they graze now through the end of December, and then they'll shut it off until they either put them back out in the spring or next fall. So, yeah, it was kind of interesting, and there are a few other folks that were at the field day that are doing it with other animals, too, because I think it was no fence. They started with either sheep or goats, and then they made bigger ones for cattle. So there's options for smaller animals, too. But, yeah, it was interesting, and it's so far working out well for them and gives them the opportunity to not have to be as intensively managing those animals while they're out on the cover crops. So, and he said as long as it's green, they'll keep moving them. So I know they're still out there. As I talked to Derek Rasper with NRCS who helped them get set up, and yeah, they're still out there. So
it was neat. They'll even track, like, if they're not feeling, like if there's very low activity or movement for a period of time.
Yep, it'll send you an alert.
Like, hey, something maybe happened.
Might want to check on this
one. Check on this one and just, yeah. I can't imagine them having like hundreds of cattle with these on. Like, it almost feel like a lot, but that is neat.
Yeah. All right. Well, that'll do it for this episode. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So today we talked about grazing and how it's not just dedicating pastures anymore. There's opportunities outside of traditional grazing and grazing paddocks. In our spotlight, we took a look at a new helicopter-sized drone that'll soon be on the market. Ag History Minute, we talked about Arthur William Sampson and his contributions to grazing. Cool Beans this week was farmer sentiment has reached highest levels since 2021. That's Corny was Cargill looking to terminate about 475 employees in Minnesota. And our Feel Good Friday was virtual fencing on Wepner Farms over in Waupaca County and how that's been helping them move animals across their cover crops. So thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.